Okay, let's move to the remaining time certain items, and let's read them together, 1190 and 1191.
1190, ratify a successor collective bargaining agreement between the city and the Portland Police Association relating to the terms and conditions of employment of represented employees in the Portland Police Association bargaining unit, and 1191, authorize agreements between the city, United States, and Portland Police Association related to police interactions with persons experiencing mental illness.
While our team is getting organized here, let me make some opening remarks and set the stage for the presentation that we're going to get on these two items here this morning. First of all, this is complicated emotional stuff and extremely important. This is the most dire relationship between the city and our citizens, which is how our police officers conduct themselves, and then how do we manage and take care of the officers who work for us in this critical bureau. So it's important stuff. It's important to get it right. We're talking about three interrelated but different items this morning and a fourth one this afternoon. That is, first, a four-year collective bargaining agreement with one of our city's largest unions, the Portland Police Association. Secondly, a memorandum of understanding between the city, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Portland Police Association. Third, a letter of agreement between the city and the Portland Police Association. And then this afternoon, fourth, proposed changes to our code that govern independent police review, which is in the auditor's office, and the police review board, which is in the police bureau. They're legally separate things, but of course they're interconnected. They all address how our police bureau functions, how it works with the community, and how we manage them, and how we hold our officers accountable. The difficult issues we'll hear about today, include the provisions of the agreement itself, how we move forward on the Department of Justice, the ability to compel testimony from officers through the independent police review function, and much more. We have a lot of work to do on these issues. These are very important milestones. They are milestones. They're not the completion of these important tasks. But I think we are making progress, and I see evidence of that as the commissioner in charge of the Bureau. I hear reports from the field, from our officers, and from our Bureau about how they're conducting themselves, and occasionally, and in fact last night, hear from citizens that are seeing how our officers are dealing with people experiencing mental illness. And I want to read this letter. It's to officers Paolini, Straub, Klunt, and Marshall. I write to compliment each of you on your handling of a situation in my apartment building last night. Sergeant Simpson shared your names with me this morning. I live across the hall from a young woman whose friend reported that she'd threatened suicide. I didn't see any part of your interaction with her, but I heard a fair amount of the lengthy conversation and believe you represented the Portland Police Bureau with distinction. You acted with compassion, empathy, and a tremendous amount of patience. I recognize the many difficulties of interacting with people who are experiencing a crisis and was very impressed with your calm and caring approach throughout. This probably wasn't an unusual incident for you, but it certainly was out of the ordinary for me, and I want to acknowledge your courtesy and professionalism. I appreciate getting that letter, and I appreciated the conduct that it recognized. That's the standard that we set as a community. That's what we want to see every time in our interactions between police officers and the community. It's what we all strive for, and it's what these agreements and understandings between the city, the federal government, and our union are setting the standard for and putting in writing. So with that, I want to ask Anna Kanwit, our HR director, and Ellen Osenak from the city attorney's office to walk us through these documents and tell us their particulars. So good morning and welcome.
Great. Thank you, Mayor and Council. As you stated, I'm Anna Kanwit, Director of the Bureau of Human Resources. I'm here to present to you the ordinance which to ratify a successor collective bargaining agreement with the Portland Police Association. This has been a long road, but the tentative agreement before you meets many of the city's very important goals and interests. It's also a fair agreement, as evidenced by the fact that 77% of the Portland Police Association members ratified this tentative agreement. Before getting into the details of the agreement, I do want to thank Daryl Turner, the PPA president, for his hard work. And when Ellen Osnick finishes her comments, he's going to come up and make some comments as well about the agreement. But his willingness to collaborate with the city while still protecting his members' interests was instrumental in getting us to where we are today. Also want to thank my chief spokesperson, Jarrell Gaddis, for his long hours and diligence in getting the work done. Of course, Mayor Hales and Chief Reese for their supporting the efforts throughout this. So what did we accomplish? The PowerPoint does provide an overview, but first and foremost, the contract is part of a broader settlement, a global settlement with the Department of Justice lawsuit regarding certain practices, the Police Bureau with respect to people with mental illnesses. As the mayor mentioned, Ellen Osnick will be presenting that agreement, but this contract is an important part of the mediated settlement with the United States Department of Justice. The Portland Police Association agreed to withdraw their grievance and a challenge to the DOJ settlement, and if the tentative agreement is not ratified by City Council, we really will not have a mediated global settlement. So I cannot stress enough the importance of this one piece of the overall settlement. It also meets a key goal that has been expressed by City Council, which is not only to obtain the mediated settlement, but also a negotiated labor agreement with the Portland Police Association. Contract is a four-year agreement and is essentially a cost-neutral agreement. The increases in the premiums that I'll be addressing will be paid for by a corresponding decrease in the contractual benefit. There is, as you know, a potential of a one-time expense over the contract savings of approximately $1.5 million, which I'll cover, but as noted by the City Budget Office, that is a one-time expense. It's a worst-case scenario here and can be addressed, if need be, in the spring bump using the compensation set aside. This tentative agreement provides clear language on performance evaluations for police officers and the other ranks represented by the Portland Police Association. Performance evaluations are an incredibly important tool. They provide a feedback loop for officers and their managers. They provide an avenue for discussion of goals and priorities, feedback on what the officer is doing well, areas to improvement, allows a meaningful dialogue between that officer and his or her supervisor over various initiatives. Goals that the officer sets, including the work they're doing in their own districts to reduce crime in this city. Again, I can't stress enough what an important management tool this is, and again, can both improve performance and also as an avenue providing very clear direction to officers about the bureaus and the city's goals and expectations. Performance evaluations do not replace employee discipline. They are two separate tracks. The Bureau has processes in place for dealing with disciplinary issues that can certainly arise out of poor performance and also arise out of acts of misconduct. That system is still in place. It's not supplanted or replaced by performance evaluation tool. But this tool, again, is an incredibly important communication process that overall can improve officer performance and understanding of Bureau goals. The Portland Police Association also agreed to accept 50% of the cost of living increase in the Portland index that the city uses. They did so in clear recognition of a shared sacrifice between labor and the city in what was a very difficult budget year, with the city facing a budgetary shortfall of approximately $25 million. This met a very important council goal as well. The increase will be 0.9%. The Portland Police Association also accepted that the city was unwilling to agree to make that increase retroactive to July 1, the date of the beginning of the new contract, absent agreement prior to that date. We did reach agreement that this COLA increase will go into effect August 29th. And again, this is a very important achievement for the city, as it does signal to our labor partners that we want to work hard on our labor agreements, but we do want to reach agreements as much as we can prior to the end, by the time our agreements actually expire, so we have them in place on July 1st. The contract eliminates a very expensive and unforeseen expense that allowed officers to cash out at their discretion compensatory time earned for working on holidays. This provision has cost the Police Bureau approximately $1.2 million a year. Effective January 1st, 2014, there will be no cash out unless the Bureau agrees to that. The savings generated by this elimination actually pay for the cost of the negotiated premiums, and again, as I mentioned earlier, does make this agreement essentially a cost-neutral one. As noted, there's a possibility of a one-time budget hit if past behavior is not a predictor of future behavior, and by that I mean over the years that this comp time provision has been in place, the cash-out provision, 39% of officers have taken advantage of cashing out all of their holiday comp time, where 61% have not done so. If those percentages hold true, the Police Bureau will not be faced with any additional costs whatsoever. The 1.5 is simply a worst-case scenario if every single person cashes out all of their holiday comp time. As part of this contract settlement, we also settled 11 grievances, which is very important in terms of labor peace and being able to move forward with important initiatives. One of those grievances was as part of the Bureau drug testing program, what happens if an officer tests positive for a steroid that's contained in a legal over-the-counter supplement? This is by no means carte blanche for officers to use steroids. If an officer tests positive for a steroid or a prohormone, that officer will be terminated. However, if the officer can show through testing of the supplement through a city-approved reputable laboratory that the substance they tested positive for was actually in a legal supplement and was not labeled, that officer doesn't face automatic termination. That does not mean their termination is not a possibility, and it doesn't mean there won't be other disciplinary actions, but it does recognize that what the officer ingested was actually a legal supplement.
Let's just say that again, Anna, because we did obviously have some confusion.
Yes.
That no, police officers are not allowed to take steroids. If they test positive and can bring in both a sealed container and one that's been opened of what they've been taking that is an over-the-counter supplement, they then pay themselves to have that tested. And if it turns out that that substance does contain steroids without it being labeled such, they must stop taking it. And there may be some discipline, but short of termination.
That is correct, Commissioner. Under the drug testing program, if it is a positive test for a drug, otherwise that for the steroids, it would be an automatic termination, outside this one exception. Since the program, we have still part of the drug testing program as well, still includes, of course, random testing, which is the best deterrent for drug use, and reasonable suspicion testing. So if there is a question regarding an officer's behavior, that officer can be tested. We've conducted over 1,000 drug tests and over 1,000 steroid tests since the implementation of this program and have never had a positive test yet for drug use or steroid use. Contract also provides for premium increases to patrol sergeants and for dog handlers. The 5% for the patrol sergeant, this is in recognition of demonstrable increases in workload, some of which arising out of the implementation of after-action reports and some other initiatives implemented by the Police Bureau. With respect to the 6% hazard premium for the canine handlers, that is in recognition that, like other hazardous assignments, the canine officers and their dogs are exposed to very hazardous and stressful situations. The dogs, I don't know if we're getting anything, but perhaps the handlers can be persuaded for an extra ration of food or something. But seriously, this is a hazardous assignment, and the contract recognizes that fact. Finally, the tentative agreement provides for increases to the shift differential for afternoons and evenings, and that is continued efforts to incent senior and experienced officers to those shifts where there really is more crime, more incidents to deal with, and those are the officers we would like to have on those shifts, and otherwise shift selections by seniority. Finally, there's a 1% increase to the longevity pay at years 15, 20, and 25%. And again, these premiums and increases are being paid for by reallocation of resources with the elimination of the holiday comp time cash out. I highly recommend council ratification of this contract. Not only does it meet the very important council goals of allowing the city to move forward with the Department of Justice settlement, it also meets council goals to provide certainty in terms of our contract negotiations and removes what otherwise would be distraction if the very people who are implementing important reforms don't know what their wages, hours, and working conditions will be with going out for a long way with our contract negotiations. So if I'm open for questions on my presentation, as the mayor mentioned, Ellen Osenek will present the memorandum of agreement, and after she's finished, Daryl Turner will also come forward with his comments. Thank you.
So I just have two questions, and thank you for the briefing that you made available to all of us on the specifics prior to today's hearing. Could you remind us that if we do not move forward with the agreement that's before us, what would likely happen in the course of negotiations, and particularly just give us a quick primer on interest arbitration?
Certainly, Commissioner. So if this agreement is not ratified, the parties will be at impasse because we have both the city and PPA worked very hard to reach a negotiated settlement. So there would be little utility in going back to the table. We would declare impasse, and with a public safety workforce, like police officers, they are prohibited from striking. So the way that contract impasse is resolved is the matter is presented to an arbitrator. Each side presents their last best offer, and an arbitrator must pick one side's package or the other. The arbitrator cannot pick and choose. The difficulty with those proceedings is time. They take a long time to schedule. The hearings are lengthy. We would not have a result for a minimum of 6 months. Likely it could take a year. And, of course, we lose control over what that contract looks like because it's the third-party arbitrator that makes that decision of and, in essence, imposes a collective agreement on the city.
I think you mentioned to me that it could add 6 months to a year of time and uncertainty to this process?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a two-week hearing at a minimum, and in our prior experience with interest arbitration, by the time we are at impasse, we are a minimum of 6 months before we get a decision, and on all likelihood, a year.
And the second thing I just wanted to clarify is the PPA agreed to shared sacrifice, as have our other labor partners, on the half COLA, and so we should acknowledge that and be grateful because it's it's effectively a pay cut, not to get a full COLA, if you look at it from one point of view. There's always a question in these negotiations of whether we make these increases retroactive. What's been our policy, and how did you resolve that in this contract?
The city's practice has been the cost of living increase we have agreed to. We have always gone back to July 1st, which is the start of the city's fiscal year and also the start of all of our collective bargaining agreements. The issues with that in terms of collective bargaining is there's very little incentive to get to an agreement if the economic pieces of the agreement are always going to be retroactive, and in my opinion has led to drawn out negotiations where otherwise we could probably reach an agreement sooner. So while the COLA is still retroactive to August 29th, it is certainly a step in the right direction and sends a very strong message to our labor partners.
Thank you.
Other questions for Anna or her team before we move to Ellen's presentation? Again, we'll take public testimony on both items after we've had the two presentations. So. Okay, thank you, Anna. Ellen, good morning.
She has a real PowerPoint.
while Carla is helping to get that set up, thank you. My name is Ellen Osenek. I'm a deputy city attorney in your city attorney's office. And I'm here today to go through the item 1191, which contains a memorandum of agreement, which is between the United States, the city, and the Portland Police Association, and then a letter of agreement that is between just the city and the Portland Police Association. I'd like to begin with some thank yous and some acknowledgments. Working on this case has given me the opportunity to work with some extraordinary people who care deeply about policing in Portland, including Anil Karia, the attorney for the Portland Police Association, and the Portland Police Association staff and members, Shauna Curfee and Ashley Albies, who are the attorneys for the AMA Coalition, and, of course, the members of the AMA Coalition, and the extraordinary attorneys at the U.S. Department of Justice. The very first one. I particularly want to thank Mayor Hales and his chief of staff, Gail Shibley, for their clear-eyed leadership throughout these complex negotiations which they inherited. Each of you on council has stepped in at various times to break log jams and provide needed feedback. Commissioner Saltzman has been part of this process from the very beginning. Commissioner Fish has provided me with invaluable guidance at critical junctures. Commissioner Fritz and her incredible staff person, Dora Perry, have kept the city focused throughout this process and journey. And Commissioner Novick and his staff, Brian Hockaday, have jumped in and were incredibly quick studies about these complex negotiations. I also want to acknowledge the leadership of Auditor LaVon Griffin-Vallade and her director, Constantine Severe. They, too, have been here from the beginning and have worked incredibly hard and diligently to move this process forward. Likewise, Chief Mike Reese has demonstrated an unwavering commitment to ensuring a principled settlement of these issues. Finally, the city is blessed to have a dedicated and whip-smart bunch of attorneys who work in your city attorney's office, and I'm honored to be able to have worked with them. In particular, Mark Amberg provided labor advice throughout these proceedings, and David Woberl, who has provided decades of dedicated service to the city on police issues, was an invaluable participant throughout these proceedings and made this settlement possible. So I'd like to walk you all through what the settlement is. And I was teased a little bit this morning that I've broken every PowerPoint rule by having a text-only PowerPoint. So it's true, but I will just attempt to go through it quickly. One of the things I thought was important for both you all and particularly for people that are here today on this item was to understand a little bit of the background of how we got to where we are today. It's been a complex two-year process that brought us to this moment. In July of 2011, the United States began a 14-month investigation of the city's policing practices, and in September of 2012, the United States concluded that systemic deficiencies in the city's policy, training, and supervisory oversight mechanisms resulted in a pattern or practice of police officers using excessive force against persons who have or are perceived to have mental illness. At that point, the United States told us that they intended to file a lawsuit against the city. So we immediately began intense negotiations with the Department of Justice, and we ultimately reached a settlement agreement that addressed the allegations. In November of 2012, the council unanimously approved that settlement agreement. After council approved the settlement agreement, the next step was to take the agreement to federal court. And I think all of you know, I think it's worth noting that in general, parties cannot resolve a lawsuit via a settlement agreement without a court's approval. So that's why we needed to take it to the court to see if they would approve the settlement, or if the court would approve the settlement agreement. At that point, two outside parties moved to intervene in the court proceedings, the AMA Coalition for Peace and Justice and the Portland Police Association. Both objected to the settlement agreement, but for opposite reasons. The AMA Coalition did not believe the settlement agreement went far enough, and the PPA believed that in some cases it went too far. The court granted enhanced amicus status to the AMA Coalition, and the court granted intervener status to the Portland Police Association. Based on Ninth Circuit case law, the court told the parties that it would not enter the settlement agreement if it contained terms that conflicted with the PPA's labor contract. The city believed that no conflict existed, and the PPA believed that conflicts did exist. Although the AMA Coalition was not granted intervener status, the court recognized that they had a special stake in the litigation. So at that point, the court asked the United States and the city to engage in mediation with all four parties. So the United States, the city, the AMA Coalition, and the PPA all participated in formal negotiations and mediation. And as you might imagine, There were, at that point, a multitude of views in the room about what would be the best way to proceed. To further complicate matters at that point, the city was collectively bargaining a successor contract with the Portland Police Association. In addition, the Portland Police Association had filed a grievance alleging that the city could not implement the settlement agreement. So we had the motion to intervene and mediation to deal with. We had collective bargaining on a successor contract, and we also had a grievance to deal with. Throughout mediation, the parties worked very hard, and we were able to negotiate a collaborative agreement with the AMA coalition, and City Council approved that collaborative agreement in July 2013. Through that collaborative agreement, the AMA coalition agreed to support the court's approval of the settlement agreement while reserving the right to advocate for further changes. The United States City and PPA were not able to negotiate an agreement through mediation, but we continued to have discussions. Part of the reason we were unable to negotiate an agreement by July was that the biggest issue the court wanted the parties to resolve was whether the DOJ settlement agreement conflicted with the PPA's labor contract. And it was not possible to really resolve that dispute until we had a successor contract in place. So at that point,
Can I just ask you something?
Yes.
If you go back one slide. You know, this issue comes up regularly here at Council. It comes up with FPD&R. Comes up with our labor contracts. It comes up in the ordinary course, and you know, I think we take for granted that this is an issue that has to be resolved and reconciled, and there's competing law. But could you just like give a two sentence, drill down a little deeper, just briefly on why it is that where there is a duty to bargain, the council can't act, or what happens if the council does act and there's a duty to bargain, and what are the legal consequences?
Where there's a duty to bargain, in general, if the council acts unilaterally without engaging in collective bargaining, then that's considered an unfair labor practice, and it would subject both the decision of council and however they implemented their decision to sort of second-guessing and being overturned, in addition to perhaps having the Employment Relations Board sustain an allegation that we had, in fact, engaged in an unfair labor practice.
And I think just by way of context, in some jurisdictions like Wisconsin, the legislature has simply stripped public sector unions of certain rights to bargain. And that's one way of addressing it. In Oregon, we have a state law that mandates that you bargain in good faith with your labor partners. And that's the law that we're bound to follow, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that clarification. So as a result of the bargaining that occurred between July and November of 2013, the city and the PPA were able to tentatively agree on a successor contract, and that's before you today in item 1190, and that Director Kanwit just explained. Once the contours, I mean, the collective bargaining and discussing potential settlements with the PPA were occurring simultaneously. But once the contours of the successor contract were in place, the city and the PPA were able to finalize those agreements and resolve the PPA's objections to the DOJ settlement agreement. And just for reference, when I say the DOJ settlement agreement, I'm referring to the settlement agreement that was approved by council in December of 2012. Because this is a global settlement, council must pass items 1190 and 1191 in order for the court to move forward in approving the DOJ settlement agreement. If either item fails to pass, the lawsuit will move away from settlement and toward further briefing and possibly trial, which is what Judge Simon indicated he believed would happen if we failed to settle the PPA's objections. So moving now to the actual substance of
excuse me, sorry to interrupt, but that means that we can't get to the fairness hearing that would be scheduled in February unless we approve both of these items.
That's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Item 1191 contains two agreements, a memorandum of agreement and a letter of agreement, and I just want to go through those briefly, mainly for the benefit of those that are here to testify and also for you all. So the terms of the memorandum of agreement, the heart of the agreement is that the PPA agreed to withdraw its objections to entry of the settlement agreement and to file any necessary court paperwork to make that happen. It also agreed to dismiss the grievance that I referred to earlier that was related to the settlement agreement. And importantly, they waived their bargaining rights to already implemented reforms, some of which I'll talk about, and Chief Reese may also talk about what those already implemented reforms are, as well as future implementation of reforms that they reasonably anticipate will occur. They retained their bargaining rights for implementation of reforms that they could not have foreseen, and they retained some bargaining rights in relation to three specific subjects in the settlement agreement. The first is the interview protocols for officers involved in force events, the IPR interview of officers, and unforeseeable court enforcement of the agreement. I want to note at this point that I have submitted an amended memorandum of agreement that has an updated reference in paragraph 9 to the proposal that you'll hear this afternoon for the changes to the IPR code. You may remember the memorandum of agreement that I submitted had a reference to the code that was introduced on October 23rd, and now I've updated it to indicate that it is they're retaining their rights to the code, that the sections of the code that are being introduced this afternoon.
And those are just changes of reference, not of substance,
That's
right?
correct.
Okay.
Ellen, does that toolbar icon on the bottom get, because it's blocking some of your text?
I know. I can't seem to get.
I don't want to make more.
Microsoft.
No, I appreciate that. I couldn't.
Microsoft moment here.
No, thank you, Carla.
Yep. Hey, congratulations.
Hey, okay. Thank you. Oh, I'll find it. Thanks.
Thank you.
I think there may have been some confusion about what paragraph 9 means in terms of, does this mean that the city agrees that they're prohibited from enacting changes to these areas? So we wanted to make it clear that the city retains its right to enact any changes to the manner in which officers are interviewed when those changes are not mandatory for bargaining. And if the PPA and city disagree about whether a change is mandatory for bargaining in one of those three areas, then we both retain our right to submit that dispute to an appropriate decision maker. The PPA retains its collective bargaining rights for matters that are unrelated to the DOJ settlement agreement. And paragraphs 11 through 9 contain housekeeping matters such as an affirmation of the due process requirement for discipline, the procedure for enforcing the memorandum of agreement, the term of the memorandum agreement, and other general legal provisions. The letter of agreement clarifies that the discipline guide, which is required by the DOJ settlement agreement, will not supplant the legal requirements of due process and just cause, but it otherwise, the city will be implementing and using the discipline guide at their discretion. So,
Ellen?
Yes.
Just to drill on that point for a moment. So, PPA has agreed that the implementation of a discipline guide is not the subject of mandatory subject of bargaining?
That's correct.
Thank you.
So, clearing the path to reform, I mean, what is the. What is the benefit of the agreements that are before you today? It's going to allow the city to confidently continue implementation of the settlement agreement without the threat of those actions being second-guessed or overturned in some other legal proceeding. For example, the city has already or is about to implement reforms to its policies, training, and accountability systems. With the settlement, those changes will be freed from the uncertainty of legal challenges. Some of the highlights of the settlement agreement include a new use of force performance and taser policies, and those will become effective January 1st of next year. Those policies are currently on the city's website, the police bureau's website. So if you Google police bureau, Portland police new use of force policies, the link will come up right away for you, and folks can look at those. These policies are incredibly important, and for many were the heart of the Department of Justice settlement agreement, and they focus on de-escalation and appropriate responses to people who are experiencing mental health crisis. The Bureau implemented a training plan that included scenario-based training incorporating de-escalation tactics such as disengaging, waiting, and calling for appropriate backup units. There are specialized responses to mental health crises that are included in the DOJ settlement agreement, including the fact that all officers will continue to be CIT trained, and the Addictions and Behavioral Health Unit will continue to advance their cutting-edge techniques for police interactions with persons experiencing a mental health crisis. And finally, there are important changes to officer accountability, including that supervisors will continue to go to the scene of all uses of force and conduct investigations, something that had been the subject of a grievance that will be resolved with this global settlement. And very importantly, the city will have a discipline guide for the first time. There will also be new thresholds in the employee information system for triggering an overall evaluation of an officer's use of force. For all of those things, the PPA has agreed to waive their bargaining rights. So those are important reforms that can move forward. There are clearly important milestones yet to come, and this global settlement does not address every concern that I think council and the community has, but it's a giant step forward toward accomplishing the goals of implementing further police reform and improving police accountability. Thank you.
Great. Ellen, thank you very much.
I have a question. While you were negotiating this settlement, which, by the way, for both of you, thank you very much for all of your good work, there was a different set of a different proposal in the independent police review for how officers could be questioned than is on the table this afternoon.
Yes.
If the council approves either this afternoon or after the fairness hearing something similar to what's in the latest proposal, how does that relate to what's in this settlement?
The original agreement, the PPA wanted to retain its bargaining rights as to those changes that the council might make to the manner in which IPR questioned officers. And the language I used in the initial draft was to say substantially similar. And so the code changes that are being presented today, we think, resolve the city's, they don't trigger mandatory bargaining. But in speaking with the PPA council, they still wish to retain their bargaining rights to that aspect of the code changes. So we simply agreed that those changes are substantially similar, and so I updated the references in the old code to correspond to the references in the new code. So that's the way it relates. It doesn't change anything substantively. They would have retained their rights to the old or the new code, but we just wanted to make it clear.
Other questions for Ellen? Great.
Daryl Turner.
Yes. So we want to call up Daryl Turner from the PPA, and then I think also the chief after that. But we'll come up together if you'd like. So thanks. Thank both of you. Obviously, we may have other questions as the hearing goes on. So. Good morning.
Morning. I'm struggling a little bit with allergies, so I'll do my best.
Anna's relieved that it's not a cold. So
it's not a cold.
She's moving away from you.
It goes away when I'm in warm weather. Mayor Harrells, commissioners, I'm Daryl Turner, the president of the Portland Police Association. I'm honored to be here today representing the 900 men and women of the Portland Police Association as the city moves to ratify a new collective bargaining agreement and the U.S. DOJ settlement. This has been a long, complex process. The city and the PPA negotiating teams worked tirelessly in weighing budget issues, policy issues, USDOJ issues, the rights of our members, and the welfare of the citizens we serve. The negotiations were tough but fair. We reached the fair and equitable tentative agreement before you only through collaboration. When I began my tenure as a PPA president 3.5 years ago, I advocated that we work collaboratively together with the city and the police bureau as issues arose. Working together towards a voluntary agreement results in a far better result than what we could have come up with after years of contentious litigation. Although this current bargaining process didn't necessarily begin with collaboration, we reached the end result only through collective hard work, dedication, and resolve. I hope that we take the core lesson that we've learned from this process, that collaboration best serves the parties, and apply it as we move forward in addressing other important law enforcement issues that we will face in the days ahead. Although there are many people who work tirelessly to get the parties to this point, I would like to especially thank Anna Kanowit, Ellen Nosnack, and Chief Mike Reese. Most of all, I would like to thank the 900 members of the PPA. Their hard work, dedication, and compassion for the community has made Portland one of the safest, most livable, and respected cities in the nation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Also, I have one little bit more to add. I do want to clarify an issue regarding the discipline guide. We agreed to use it as an advisory tool, such as the PRB. But the PPA did not agree that the discipline guide is not a mandatory subject of bargaining, nor do we agree that it is a mandatory for bargaining. We simply agreed on how to use the guide. So I wanted to add that.
Duly noted. Thank you. All right, Chief.
Sounds like you kept your options open.
Yes.
All right.
Mayor and Commissioners, I appreciate the opportunity to address Council this morning. The collective bargaining agreement and the MOA are a positive step forward for the community and the Portland Police Bureau. It is morally and ethically appropriate for us to own these reform measures and to begin the work immediately. And I'm very proud of the work that we've already done. We didn't wait until today to begin the processes and implementation of the reform measures. We used the settlement agreement that was drafted and approved by Council last year as a roadmap, and we will continue to use it as a roadmap to move forward. We have done good work already, and we anticipate doing much more good work. It is challenging work. There are too many people in mental health crisis in Oregon, and certainly not enough resources to assist them. We know as a Portland Police Bureau that we can always do better, and we are committed to continuous improvement, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to show Council that improvement. In regards to the collective bargaining agreement, it helps to provide certainty as we move forward with the DOJ settlement agreement, and that we're not going to have labor strife over issues that are important for our community and important to the Bureau. It has important changes that are fiscally responsible and provide improved accountability, and those include some of the things that Anna mentioned earlier, such as the employee evaluations. And I want to also close by thanking Ellen Osenak, Jarell Gaddis, and Anna Kanowit for their hard work and leadership on this, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Questions for Darrell or the Chief?
I do have a follow-up question on the issue of a discipline guide. I mean, it seemed to me that having a discipline guide is a critical piece of what we're doing going forward, and it's important to have consistent discipline, and I think that that will be reassuring to the citizens and also to members of the force, so I've heard express concern about inconsistent discipline. And also, I would hope that having a consistent discipline guide would ultimately lead to different results in arbitrations and ERB proceedings, where it's my impression that sometimes the city has been on the losing end, partly because we've had a record of inconsistency. I'm a little confused, Mr. Turner, by what you just said compared to what Ellen Osenak just said. It was my understanding that you had said that you would not argue that implementation of a discipline guide is the subject of mandatory bargaining. I'm wondering, based on what you just said, whether when there's an attempt to implement discipline based on the guide, you will argue that, you know, that needs to, that each element of the guide needs to be bargained.
No, because the police chief and the police commissioner have control over discipline. So obviously, we knew that even though it's an advisory guide, that it would be used as a springboard for discipline by the chief and by the police commissioner when they have that right to do that. So we understand that they have the right to use the discipline guide as a tool for discipline.
I might put words in both of their mouths, and I think my understanding of this fits both of those perspectives, and that is the discipline guide, if you look at it, is a matrix of choices for the party who gets to exercise discipline, namely the commissioner in charge and the chief. Judgment is still involved. It's not like there's no discretion or no judgment whatsoever involved in the exercise of discipline, but there are parameters around what each type of failure receives in terms of discipline. I think it's extraordinarily clear and useful, while still acknowledging the fact that real people who exercise judgment are still in the loop, and you can't, nor should you, try to have a discipline guide that's so mechanical that no exercise of judgment by the chief or the commissioner in charge would even be possible. That would be crazy and wouldn't work. But I think this this is clear enough and definitive enough that if you do this, you will be subject to a range of discipline that looks like that. And I do believe that it will be reassuring to our officers and also pushing them in the right direction, and that it will give the chief the opportunity to look at particular circumstances around a situation, mitigating or aggravating circumstances that, you know, in this particular case, it was even worse that you did this, or in this particular case, it's a little more understandable that you did this. That range of discretion is appropriate, but also having some clarity for the community, for the officers, for everybody involved, that this is these are the rules. I think we're as close as human nature allows in the management of discipline with this matrix.
But Mayor, can I just put a finer point on that? Because I think Commissioner Novick raises an excellent point. Our understanding, based on the testimony, therefore, as a council, is that we have a discipline guide, which you and the chief will use, that if the PPA believes that the facts or the law do not support a decision, or that somehow the guide has been applied inconsistently, they would, of course, have the right that they have, pre-existing right, to grieve that and go through the ordinary course and have an arbitrator decide that. But my understanding is that they will not be filing concurrently an unfair labor practice saying that you and the chief are without legal authority to refer to a discipline guide because it has not been bargained. Is that correct?
If the discipline guide is an advisory tool, they can still use it. We understand that the chief and the commissioner will be able to use it, yes.
And so, again, it doesn't impact the right of a member and the union to bring a grievance.
Grieve discipline, as we always have had that right.
We have an agreement that says a higher authority can ultimately decide the question, but it would not be accompanied by an unfair labor practice saying you don't have the right to refer to this discipline guide.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Other questions, for the chief or for Anna or for Mr. Turner?
Chief, I did have a question about the 48-hour rule, which has been the subject of considerable controversy. And it's my understanding that although the agreement with PPA says that we will continue to generally have a 48-hour rule, that you have discretion in some cases to order compelled testimony and investigation before 48 hours has elapsed. And I wonder if you could talk about whether there are some circumstances in which you would use that discretion.
I don't know of any circumstances where we've used that recently. I can foresee opportunities where we may. Certainly the PPA has an officer bill of rights that carves out a part of that. One of the rights is that they have 48-hour notice prior to an administrative hearing or where we compel testimony. And in the past, there is some exceptions to that. In the past, we haven't used that. I can see where, for example, there's a timeliness issue. So you may have an investigation underway. You're interviewing one member, and in the course of that interview, information comes out that you want to bring in and compel testimony from another member, and you find out that member is perhaps leaving town the next day. So you may employ that 48-hour rule exception to bring that member in to get that testimony so that we're not delaying the course of the investigation. These are often complicated, certainly by criminal matters. So if you have an officer-involved shooting or a case that involves criminal culpability, you're going to have the district attorney's office involved in that decision-making as well.
Can you express what your response would be to a citizen who said that we shouldn't give people 48 hours to before their testimony is compelled? That sounds like we're just sort of giving them time to get their story straight.
Again, these are administrative hearings. They often occur long after an incident has occurred. So, for example, in the case of a citizen complaint where we're doing a thorough and complete investigation, that complaint may be 2 or 3 weeks after the event. So the investigators have to give the employee notice. We have to pull reports. We may want to interview the complainant and other people prior to interviewing the officer.
Other questions?
If I may just add a little bit to that point. As the chief mentioned, you know, best practice when you're conducting an investigation is generally to collect all of the relevant information that you can before you do your interviews of what, in this case, you know, in a forced situation or a citizen complaint, the officer would be the respondent. And when you get to that point of doing those questions, it's much more effective, obviously, if you have the investigator has as much information as he or she possibly can have. And in that respect, those investigations really aren't that much different from the other investigations we conduct in the city. But, you know, as the chief mentioned, this is very, very complicated, particularly because of the nature of police work, and that police officers, you know, part of their job, unfortunately, is to use force when necessary. And there are can be issues, as the chief said, with compelling testimony. If they're in with use of force, as they know, there's always a potential issue of criminal culpability. Also the issue of those events are very traumatic. And there are studies that other attorneys can talk about here today that do caution against immediate interviews. But again, the contract language does provide for where the delay would impact the investigation, would jeopardize the investigation. Those interviews can take place prior to 48 hours, or if criminal culpability is not an issue, the interviews can take place prior to 48 hours. So there's not an absolute prohibition in the contract language.
I will say, when we have timeliness issues or we have a compelling reason to pull an officer in, the PPA has cooperated in many of these instances. And so we haven't had to force an officer to come in without representation in that type of setting.
There's another issue that I wanted to talk about a bit, and it might actually be helpful to have Ellen back up to address it with relate to the DOJ agreement.
Come on up, Ellen. Just bring a chair with you if you want.
And this is an issue which I wish I'd known about and thought about earlier, but the DOJ settlement says at page 42 that the Citizen Review Committee appeals will be resolved within 21 days. And I had the member of the CRC come to me some days ago and say that that's not really a realistic timeline for a group of volunteers, many of whom have full-time jobs, to review the information and get together and render a decision. And, Alan, it's my understanding that that's a point that the city made in discussions with DOJ, and DOJ wasn't very receptive. Is that fair?
I would say that's very fair. It's certainly a concern that has been expressed in numerous forums. Both I know Commissioner Fritz is very aware of this issue. During the course of even mediation, we talked again about that issue and just were not able to get a compromise with the Department of Justice on that. Having said that, I think their position is also that they actually wanted a much stricter timeline than 180 days, and the 21 days is part of that 180 days. So what we, I think, have gotten them to agree to is that if we are not able to achieve substantial compliance, so, for example, if the CRC could not achieve substantial compliance with the 21 days, that issue, since it has been raised repeatedly by both advocates and the city, I think is certainly something that in the future, if we were not able to achieve substantial compliance, we put them on notice, and I believe that there would be room to negotiate in the future about it.
I mean, I hope that's true, but I am concerned by the fact that the language does, and I understand you worked hard on this. My beef is really with DOJ. I mean, I'm concerned by the fact that the language says, you know, appeals to CRC shall be resolved within 21 days. And I just, I mean, I don't think that complainants generally are going to complain about the timeline being too long because they exercised the right to the appeal to the CRC and that took more than 21 days. I mean, I would think that from a complainant standpoint, the timeliness issue would relate to our investigation that precedes that. And I am very concerned that we might lose people from the CRC, and it might actually be impossible to maintain a CRC if they're faced with a timeline that they simply can't meet. And I will say that last week I called Amanda Marshall and asked her about this, and she said no, it was very important to the Civil Rights Division that we keep to the 180-day timeline, and in fact, they thought that the delays of the CRC was a big fat problem, so they wanted to do something about it.
But Commissioner, I'm going to have some suggestions when we do the IPR ordinance this afternoon, because I share your concern.
Thank you.
Good. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mayor,
yes.
we may want to move the amendment before taking
yes.
further testimony.
Thanks, Tracy.
So
yes.
Second.
The amendment's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Roll call on putting the amended version on the table.
And nope. could we just have Ellen briefly say what the amended what the amendment is? Just one sentence, please.
The amendment is to paragraph 9, subsection II, and it updates the information to conform to an item being heard later today.
Thank you.
Just by referring to the right code sections, right? Okay. Okay. Roll call then.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye.
Okay. So that amended version is now in front of us as along with the other item, and we can take testimony on both. Because we're hearing two items together, we'll give people 4 minutes instead of three. I don't know if you have a sign-up sheet.
I have two sign-up sheets.
Two sign-up sheets, so let's begin.
You want to combine, because some have signed up on both.
So. Yes, please. Let's combine them, and again, give people a chance to testify on both items at once rather than make them wait.
Okay, I'll start with the list on 1190. The first three are Dr. T. Ellen Bethel, Shauna Kerfee, Dan Handelman.
Come on up. Good morning and welcome. Whatever order the three of you would like to go in. Dr. Bethel, first.
Good morning, Dr. T. Allen Bethel, President of Alabama Minister Alliance and also the Vice Chair of the AMA Coalition. Justice and Police Reform. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council, for the opportunity to be able to speak this morning, considering the two documents or legislation that things that are before you. Number one, we want to talk simply just a few things about the CBA. We believe that there have been some missed opportunities in dealing with the CBA agreement. Number one in those, we will talk about the 48-hour rule, which you have raised also from the council, is that we do find that there is nothing mandating that the city has to bargain about the 48-hour rule or the IPR's ability to compel officers' testimony. The city, we believe, could have just simply struck that out of the contract, not dealt with it, and I believe that it is a missed opportunity to have not cleared this clearly. That it will ever be in the future construed as a mandatory bargaining right. Secondly, it was not brought out, but it is a part of the contract that talks about drug testing, and particularly that piece around the use of steroids and being found in a particular product that an individual officer may use. It was not aware that there was a steroid inside of that particular product. I am believing that we have missed because there is nothing that then strictly forbids that officer from using that product again, knowing that it does contain steroids. If for the United States Olympics and for athletes and other groups, the use of steroids are completely forbidden and you can lose and even be stripped of things, we feel that that should be strongly enhanced in that as well when we talk about drug testing. Performance reviews that have been absent for many years, not only in the Portland Police Association or the Bureau, but in some other departments. But in particularly in this CBA, it talks about that we will not use them to determine anything about transfers, discipline, or promotion. What's the use of having an evaluation if the evaluation is not to help to instruct, to correct, and to move forward and improve what a particular officer has done or is doing? And just to leave it as something that is done that has no real impact, I don't believe, once again, that we have taken the opportunity to strengthen what this contract is going to be and can be. Finally, when we talk about the discipline guide, and that was one that was just brought up recently that I added just a few notes on, is that many times if this, what we find is that when something goes to arbitration around an officer in the Portland Police Bureau, most officers have been returned, sadly to say. None of the discipline seems to stick. Off for a few minutes, we might say, would equal some months and weeks. But in the end, they come back, and then they are repaid. I think